Welcome to the new podcast, Addiction, An Hour with Hour, where Dr. Michael Auer and myself, John Bruford, talk to experts from around the world as we take a holistic view of addiction. With gambling addiction at its heart, we aim to explore adjacent issues and look at addiction itself with the finest researchers and academics, alongside experts from other areas. This first episode, we meet Leon Zhao, assistant professor at City University Hong Kong, and Leon's specialism is blind boxes and loot boxes, which are obviously gambling adjacent, if not just plain gambling. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to a sideways step for the Gambling Files umbrella of podcast brands, as we launch our first podcast that is serious. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Michael Auer, and our first guest on this new project, Assistant Professor Leon Zhao, who is at the School of Creative Media, City University of Hong Kong. I think I got all the words in the right order. Leon, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Auer, you're very quiet there. That's a little worrying.
It's not typical for me, isn't it?
No, it's not. I thought you'd been replaced by a waxwork for a second.
but I'm good. I'm real. I'm not an AI. I don't know how I can prove it, but...
That's just what an AI would say.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all fucking doomed. Leon, thank you so much for joining us. So the path to invite you on to here was... So Michael and I were talking about... doing this podcast, and I was driving along and my car was in the garage and I couldn't work out how to attach my phone to the rental car they gave me, the loaner they gave me, right? And whenever I turned the car on, Radio 4 was on, and I was driving along and Radio 4 was on, and Woman's Hour came on, and they did a bit on blind boxes, and that's what me and Michael have been talking about. And I was like, whoa, this is serendipity. I mean, so many factors have combined for me to be listening to this right now. And you came on in that segment, and it was so interesting. And it was really interesting that Woman's Hour is looking at blind boxes. And the big driver for this in the media has been, and stop me if I get the name of this wrong, but Labubu.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's the most popular product that people can get out of blind boxes, especially. Yeah.
Are you a collector yourself?
No. But I do have some colleagues who work very close to me who do collect these things.
That's interesting. So, yeah. And do you ever quote your studies to them?
I do actually speak with them sometimes, because it's good to actually know what people who engage with these products experience and feel about these products, right? Always with the video game research or the car pack research that we do, I do think it's quite important to either have lived experience yourself or to at least consult people with lived experience.
Yeah, definitely. So for our listeners who might not be familiar with your work, what are the kind of things that you've been working on that involve blind boxes? I mean, basically, I'm asking you to legitimize why we've come to talk to you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, most of the time I actually spend researching virtual blind boxes inside video games. I think today we're mostly here to talk about the physical products. The two are very similar in that the consumer is spending money to purchase a container. They don't know what they're going to get from this particular container. They have some information. They know, for example, that they are guaranteed to get one Labubu doll, but they don't know which color that Labubu doll will be, for example. And then to find out which one they've obtained, they have to open either this blind box, or in the video game context, we call it a loot box or a gacha mechanic. So the spending of money on randomized content.
What was the name of that mechanic again? Sorry.
A video game loot box or a gacha mechanic.
Gacha mechanic.
a gacha mechanic.
Gacha?
Yes, it comes.
How do you spell that?
Gacha. It comes from Japanese.
Gacha. Okay.
From gachapon. It's those capsule dispensers where you put a coin in, and then they're in these little plastic balls, and then a random one falls down. But it sounds like gacha when you twist the handle and then the thing falls down. Yeah. It's a gachapon machine, and then because that was also spending money on randomized content, and when that was included inside video games, in the Japanese games, they call them gacha mechanics.
I have the feeling, you know, at least, you know, among the research community, and I think also, let's say, you know, the, you know, our average, you know, person out there, they sort of have an idea, at least, you know, here in Europe, probably in the US, to what a loot box is meantime, because it's been discussed so much, and, you know, all of the adolescents, you know, and of course many adults play video games, and the loot box is a way to monetize the game, isn't it? So in your research, when do you see, did the loot boxes come up? Like, when did they actually originate? So when did all of this start? So when did they switch from, okay, I play a video game, either I purchase this thing like it was before. So when I grew up, you know, I had a Commodore C64. I mean, none of you probably know that, you know, where you had, okay, John knows.
I was there.
So you had to put command $8.1 to start the game, blah, blah, blah. And then you had the Nintendo where you had the cassettes and then later on the discs. And at some point of time, it was all digital. But when did they actually come up with the concept of, you know, in-purchase gaming? Let's put it that way. If you trace it back, it all started with, okay, there's a game. You might buy the game, but then you have the option to buy stuff there.
Yes, I would say this traces back to the early 2010s. In some cases, some people would trace it even earlier to this so-called horse armor in the Elder Scrolls series. So this was a costume that players could purchase for the horse in a very specific game. It started that way. It was something that additional that a player could purchase for a premium game that they have already bought. So they already have the game, they purchased it, but if they wanted some additional content, they pay a little bit of money on it. But then later on, we had these so-called free-to-play games where the game product is offered for free. You can download it, you can play it, at least you can start playing it. Mm-hmm. But to monetize it, because there was no longer that initial purchase to generate revenue, they sell things inside the game. And they sell things for more money, or they sell more things, or they get you to purchase the same things multiple times in order to generate enough revenue. Especially now on mobile game platforms, we're looking at more than 80% of the popular games containing in-game purchases and especially loot boxes. For PC and console games, so we're thinking PlayStation, Nintendo consoles, the prevalence of loot boxes and in-game purchases are lower because many games are still sold just as a software and they do not offer any sort of in-game purchases. Mm-hmm. However, some of the most popular games on those platforms do have these mechanics in. So they will sell you the software, and then they will still try to sell you more things once you get inside the game.
So just you know, to clarify, so the loot box means there is a random component to it. So the player purchases a package for a predefined amount of money, and then they are you know, rewarded by either a large price, a low price, or there might be nothing in there, right? I mean, or could that also be the case that it's basically empty? Or is there always something, but they just don't know what it is?
In very few games, you might have situations where the loot box is empty in the sense that it gives you something that you already have, and it just seems as if you received absolutely nothing. But in most games, you will get something. But the thing is, that something is basically worthless, or it is worth so little that it's just like it is nothing, but technically you did get something. And this happens most of the time. You'll get something that you don't want, and it's worth very little, but only very rarely would you get what you're actually looking for.
And is this always random? Like, is this always random, or do the online gaming companies, you know, apply strategies to sort of lure players? You know, in gambling, we have this concept called gambler's fallacy. Like, you know, if you lose consecutively, that you believe now, you know, it must be more likely for me to win because I've lost 10 times. In like the real world gambling, this is random because the roulette wheel or the slots, they are all certified and it's random. But in the gaming, there are no such rules and no such certifications. So would they then, you know, give somebody something more likely if they had just, you know, a horrible losing streak?
Yes, actually. This wasn't a thing. At least it wasn't as popular a thing. If we go back further in time. But if we're talking about the products now, most of them actually offer a so-called pity or guarantee mechanic that says that if you purchase, for example, 90 loot boxes, or rather if you purchase 89 loot boxes and you don't get a rare item, then on the 90th loot box, we guarantee giving you this rare item. You can still, based on the original probabilities, try to get it on the initial 89 attempts, but on the 90th attempt, it's guaranteed if you didn't get it for all those previous attempts. So this is super interesting because, of course, the gambler's fallacy is a fallacy in the traditional gambling context, but the gambler's fallacy is true, or the companies make it true in the video game context, right? And I think this comes down to how gambling, traditional gambling, is a zero-sum game. If the gambler wins, the casino loses. It's not possible to guarantee that you will sometimes win. Then the casino will be losing money. But for the loot box video game context, technically, if you think about it, if the company gives out rare rewards, it's not actually losing money. It's not losing money in the sense that a casino losing a gambling game is losing money. Yes, perhaps it reduces how much revenue they can generate from the same thing, but making another copy is technically free.
So, you know, you might not, you know, heard about this, and, you know, it's rarely sort of mentioned, but I spend lots of time, you know, assessing game risk, you know, I mean, in gambling, of course. And interestingly, in the Netherlands, as well in Belgium, games are not 100% random in the land-based. And that's sort of originates really historically when you really weren't able to build good random generator mechanisms. So in the slot machines, you know, in the Netherlands, they pay out, they supposed to pay out a certain amount over a period of time, you know, and their players really sort of have a small edge if, you know, they monitor the machine.
Yes, right. Yes.
And then at some point of time, it has to sort of level out, you know, its payout because it's not 100% random. But what you are saying is that in gaming, the pity mechanism really fires up this gambler's fallacy. And it would be interesting. I mean, did you ever assess psychologically, you know, gambling fallacy, those kinds of things in the online gaming market?
We never got around to, our team at least. And it is quite interesting because I think for most gambling researchers, these this sort of, it's a weird manipulation of the gambler's fallacy would raise alarm bells. However, when we asked whether players like this sort of mechanic, the majority actually said yes, they like it because it helps them to predict the maximum amount of money that they need to spend to get what they want. And also, this information is presented, this pity information, such as for every 90 loot box you purchase, you are guaranteed to get a rare item, is more easier, I would imagine, to understand than the probabilities that companies are required to disclose. For those, it's quite complicated to figure out exactly what it means and what the implications of that are. But this is just one sentence and people get it. So I think people are following the pity mechanic to plan their purchases if they're planning.
I think it's really interesting that we have in gambling, you know, we have this sort of prescribed level of payout or whatever, and in gaming, it's a theoretical, as in it's assumed rather by the player. There's no requirement for it to be so, and I think that's quite interesting that there's no stipulations around that. One of the things about loot boxes, and this does tie back in to blind boxes, is that there is very, very little transparency. So you're just told that something is scarce. You don't know the frequency of it. In my experience, you're never told these things.
From what I observe with the Labubus, at least, they do tell you. Based on a fraction, what your odds are of getting each specific item is. It's usually a 1 out of 6 for the 6 ordinary ones, and then it's 1 out of 144, I want to say, for the chase one. It does say right on the package.
But does that mean that the distribution is also monitored of that? Because if I buy a Labubu here in Shropshire, that's not necessarily the same as buying a Labubu in London. So if they're saying this is the percentage, is that a percentage of just the overall numbers of Labubu that are in the country, or is that a percentage based on the actual distribution of those? Because that's going to be different.
Now, you assume that they are distributed randomly.
I guess this is a difference between the real world and, well, I guess it's also true in the video game context. No, right. I see what you mean. So with the physical product, let's say that there is one rare thing out of 144 boxes. Let's say that that box has been purchased by the first person who decided to buy a box. Then actually for the next 143 purchases, people's chances of getting it is not 1 out of 144, but it's actually 1 out of 0. Just 0, because it's already got. But in the video game context, there's no like limit on how many rare items there are, and each result should be randomly generated. So yes, I see what you mean, right? So the probability disclosure is not necessarily true. It's true, I suppose, in terms of how many they produced officially. Yeah.
But it's not necessarily realistic.
No. If it's so, gone.
I think that's really interesting. Like if I were bringing in legislation about this, that would be the thing I would address. There's a type of gambling called pull tab gambling, right? Which is a little bit like doing scratch cards or whatever. So if you buy scratch cards, say you buy scratch cards online in the UK, it tells you how many jackpots have been won, etc. So you kind of know there's this many tickets left, there's blah, 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 right? And that's great. And pull tab gambling works in a similar way. You know that there are 30,000 tickets, say, and you know that 24,000 have been sold and nobody's got the jackpot yet. So actually your 1 in 6,000 is a much sexier than your 1 in 30 was. And that can drive sales. That transparency can drive sales. And of course, equally, it can kill sales. But the player knows exactly what they're buying into. They know what jackpots are left. They know what the probability is. And I think that's really fascinating. It's a form of gambling that's more often used by charities. But I do think it's really interesting for the player because it's a completely different psychology.
And another point related to this is that with the scratch cards, presumably one is exactly the same as the other. You cannot physically distinguish them. But in this blind box, blind bag product context, you do have... with some products, the possibility of weighing them, because different ones do not weigh the same amount. There is also a culture of shaking the box, or squeezing the bags to feel, because some characters are quite different from others. Some of the content, like one character has a really long sword, let's say, then it's possible for you to feel it. And so there's also this aspect, right? So again, it potentially is not as randomized as it says on the box. If you just purchase the box, right, if it's a fresh box. Oh, and then there is also, I know in some shops that sell this, they would say whether it's a fresh box or if it's a box that people have already taken something out of. Because with a lot of these products, it does come as a big box containing six smaller boxes. And usually one of those six boxes will contain one each of the six possibilities. So if you buy a big box, you get one of each, except that there is a small chance of there being a rare one that replaces one of the six normal ones, let's say. So if it's a fresh box, it should be the six. Or alternatively, you get five different ones, and then you get the secret rare one, in which case you're happy. But if it's not a fresh box, you never know.
God, that's annoying.
So and Leon, the blind boxes, did they originate in China? I mean, is this something, or when did this actually become popular? After COVID, during COVID, or has this been there for a very long time?
Surely the blind box concept started in Germany, because the
earliest
thing I can think of is Kinemax.
I know, but we have a similar thing. We have the football cards that you collect.
So I mean,
even when I, you know, was in elementary school, that was very popular among the boys. Whenever there was a World Cup, you bought, you know, the cards, and you, of course, the packages are blind. And then another thing that we had, we call it Wundertüte, like Wonder bag. So it was like a bag, and again, you know, with fireworks and stuff, you know, on it, I mean, pictured, and you got like random items in it. And of course, everybody knows, I mean, I'm not sure, Leon, if you have this in China, the Kinder Surprise egg, like a chocolate egg with a toy inside. And here, people are also quite, you know, fanatic about collecting the surprise.
I think it's quite hard to really trace the history of these things, because I think these products do also learn from each other. With some of the newer card pack products that we have, I think they are also adopting some of the concepts and some of the mechanics from the blind boxes or even from the loot boxes. But I would say that at least for the Labubus that we're talking about, it is around COVID, really, that it's taken off from mainland China. And we do know that a significant amount of the revenue for these things are being generated still from China. It's getting increasing international popularity, especially since the start of this year. But then again, it has also really died down quite a lot now after the mad rush earlier this year. I was looking at Google, lets you look at how frequently a particular term is searched for. And Labubu is being searched for a lot less now compared to June, when I think it peaked.
But Labubu is just one product, right?
Correct. But it has been the one that I think managed to, it is the only one that's really managed to enter into the mainstream consciousness. I think people have always been around to collect cards, like you said, football cards, baseball cards. People have always been around to collect toys, but this Labubu has managed. And I think, John, going back to what you said earlier about Women's Hour, I think Labubu got featured because it was the only one that actually, people who are not necessarily collecting hobbyists have gotten into, and it's the only one. Perhaps, you know, there were the Beanie Babies craze a while ago, those are few and far in between. But these products continue. Like they've always been available, but it was quite specialist people who engaged in them. But this time, it's mainstream people engaging with it. But perhaps that trend has stopped. I think it's certainly cooled down quite a lot.
I think it's interesting something you said a minute ago about how these things learn from each other. Because, of course, Kinder, traditionally, was just you get an egg, it's got a toy in it. But they've been doing limited series editions, haven't they? They've done a Marvel one, and Jesus Christ, my kids have me spunking money on that. And they've done a DC one, and they're around for 6 months or whatever. Mm. And you want to get all your favorites, et cetera, et cetera. I ended up trading with the lady who worked on the checkout in Sainsbury's. What can I say? We couldn't get the Flash anywhere. We couldn't get Green Lantern. She had them both. So I traded my alternate reality Flash with her. Anyway. But the point is that, yeah, they are. They totally learn from each other. One thing I did want to ask you, Leon, is, and this probably sounds like a stupid question, but so I was talking to Professor Abarbanel last week about this podcast and stuff. And she was talking about loot boxes because it's something she's studied extensively as well. She was talking about a Star Wars game that kind of saturated and broke the model almost, although this FIFA, which is always going to be there doing what it does.
Yes, that's Star Wars Battlefront 2 by EA. This was the game where this game actually they removed the loot boxes in the end. But this was, I think, perhaps the first game that was already being sold for a lot of money because it's just a premium game. But then they tried to monetize again with loot boxes inside it. So they were trying to double dip.
And I
think also it was part of the initial experimenting, I would still say, at least from the AAA Western video game companies with this sort of mechanics, in that it perhaps was not designed as, in a way that is as player friendly as they might now be, or people it would expect them to be nowadays. I think people calculated how likely it was, or rather how long it would take for you to get Darth Vader just by playing the game without paying. And it was something ridiculous, like 2 or 3 years. But, you know, if you pay £60 for a video game, for a Star Wars game, you would expect to play as Darth Vader without having to, you know, work for years.
Before you die.
Yes, and what more interestingly, before the next game in the series releases, so then it's all wasted because you now want to get Darth Vader in a new game, right?
Yeah, are EA, I mean, I used to work on games magazines, so I know a fair bit of EA's history.
Yeah.
And they've done lots of series and all of that. And I was talking to Fintan Costello recently, and he was saying that the way that FIFA works, you know, his son's really into FIFA and he's built this great team for this season.
Yeah.
And they all disappear and you have to build again from scratch next season.
Yeah.
That feels really cynical to me. And as a player, I would feel not cheated because you know what you're doing when you go into it, but an advantage, a heavy advantage, comes from spending money in these things. It's not a level playing field without spending money, and you've already bought the game. It doesn't feel nice.
No, it leaves a bad taste, right? Especially also with the football games, you are looking at a lot of young people, young boys playing these games, right? And I guess from a philosophical perspective, it's a good idea to teach them basically that if you spend money, you can be stronger. And also it speaks to the fairness point, right? I mean, look, it's also true that in professional sports, it is a given really that spending money will give you an advantage. Better training facilities, better equipment, etc. So, you know, real life sport is also not fair if you think about it, but at least we sort of pretend it is, or we sort of collectively agree that to a certain extent we will think of it as fair. At least people are starting from the same, they're starting on the same line, they're running for the same distance. At least there are things like that. But yeah, with the FIFA context, even some of those very basic principles have been frustrated.
But historically, a game, especially games where you can play peer-to-peer, it was all about your skills with the controller, your understanding of the game, rather than being able to artificially weight it. And it has taken that out. You can play somebody and you can know you're going to lose before you start the game.
Yes.
And that the game company, it's not the understanding of fairness in that obviously completely flawed and ridiculous thing we try and teach children.
Yeah.
It's the concept of fairness in that it doesn't matter how good you are with this. If that dude spent £200, you are fucked.
And but you know, the game companies go around saying, oh, well, you know, in-game purchases are not necessary for gameplay. Technically not, but it is necessary for competitive gameplay, where if you actually want to play for real, or, you know, if you want to take it seriously. And I think this becomes even worse in the context of esports, which is something that a lot of countries are trying to develop, especially amongst young people. Lots of potential benefits to this, right? But you have a lot of esports games where it is possible and it is indeed necessary to spend money on these mechanics before you can compete at all. This has, for example, led to Belgium has really strict regulation on loot boxes. And this basically means that if you are a Belgian person, you cannot compete. It is not possible. You have to move to a different country, or you have to at least pretend to the game that you're living in a different country so they sell you these things so you can compete.
How does that actually work? So I saw your paper, you wrote a couple about Belgium. Yep. So how do they attempt to regulate the loot box in Belgium?
Yep, so there was no new law that was adopted to deal with loot boxes. However, it just so happens that the gambling law that already existed in Belgium was very far-reaching and very strict. And that meant that loot boxes would be covered by the pre-existing gambling regulation. In other countries, most loot boxes are not covered because whatever you win stays with you. Yeah. So in Belgium, because of that pre-existing law, it would be necessary for a video game company to apply for a gambling license before they can offer loot boxes. However, this is actually not a category of gambling that the regulator can license. So it's actually not possible at all to offer loot boxes in a lawful way, even if you wanted to get a gambling license. So technically, these things are banned. But with the exception of a few companies that have followed the law, generally, games are still being sold with loot boxes in Belgium, as if it's perfect.
Yeah, because, I mean, quickly about Belgium, so it happens, I'm quite familiar with this because I did a couple of projects there. Maybe it's also interesting for the listener. In Belgium, for example, the online gambling law has three categories. So they have a concept called dice games. That's their own category of games. And again, you know, they are quite specific in terms of the mechanics, the randomness, and so on and so forth. Then they have casino, like slots, roulette, and they have sports betting. So there you have online gambling companies, which might only offer dice games, specific, you know, games. I mean, of course, simulated online or casino and or sports betting. And probably that sort of is so broadly formulated that it would also apply to the loot boxes because you have this element of randomness there. But like, I mean, how would you, I also saw you wrote one paper and I think you studied the 100 most popular games for mechanics. How do you even, you know, find out about a game containing a loot box? Because some games you might have to play for a very long time to achieve a certain level. It might come in very late, you know, in the game mechanics, only when you have achieved a certain status or a certain guild. And it might be completely concealed too.
Well, luckily for us, because this is so important for generating revenue for these games, most companies will try to sell it to you within a few minutes. And so, for example, we would find that more than 80% of the games would already have tried to sell this within just 1 hour of gameplay.
Oh, really?
So
okay,
that's what we always say. We will spend this amount of time looking at it. And if we don't find one within this time, we say that we didn't find it. But that means that the availability of these products could only be higher because, like you said, there are ones that we couldn't find in time. Mm. But for the ones that we already found, that's already a lot.
Mm.
Yeah. I meant to ask you a question earlier, and I actually didn't get to the question because I just went off on a tangent. And this might sound stupid, right? Is there, I can see the link between a retail blind box and a digital loot box. Mm. Is the path from one to the other in a developmental term, in the evolution of these things, is the path as obvious as it looks? And is the psychological action the same? Is it identical? So I guess what I'm saying is,
yeah.
Are we learning this gambling mechanic at the retail level and it's then normalized and acceptable when we encounter it in a game when we're a little older?
I'm not sure how which way this necessarily goes now, because we also have young people engaging with video games at a very early stage, and especially in old jurisdictions, except Germany and Australia at the moment, no age restriction is placed on loot boxes. The game will be rated based on its other content, but loot box presence is not taken into account. So that means we're looking at young people engaging with these things really early as well. So they might actually encounter a loot box before they get to a physical blind box. And I think maybe in the sort of teenage years, one might be reinforcing the other in a sort of cycle. But what we do know is this. I think certainly that there is wide availability of gambling-like products in general that are not regulated in law as a form of gambling. That's number one. And then number two is we haven't yet, nor has anybody else, done any research on the link between experiencing gambling harms and purchasing blind boxes.
Oh, really?
But okay. Not yet. We're planning this right now, and we're hoping to get it done next year. But what we have done are studies between experiencing gambling harm and video game loot boxes. This has also been done by many other research groups across the world in many different jurisdictions, in different contexts, both adolescents and adults, etc., etc. But we have also done research looking at experiencing gambling harms or problem gambling and physical card packs. So think about the Pokemon packs and whatnot, which I think sits somewhere in between the loot boxes and the blind boxes, in that they are also used as part of a game, but it's a physical game. But then they are in the physical context rather than the virtual context. But anyway, we've done this with virtual loot boxes, physical card packs. We haven't done it for the physical blind boxes yet. But the point here is that the relationship between purchasing loot boxes and problem gambling is stronger than the relationship between purchasing physical card packs and problem gambling, which I think is a point to observe, in that it is possible that video game virtual loot boxes may be more harmful, similar to how an online slot machine game might be more harmful than, say, a physical scratch card.
Now, I think there's an important element in the physical cards in that it has a strong social aspect. That's super important, surely. But you've just touched on something there, and I just scribbled a note down to make sure I didn't forget to ask this, right? And I think you might have answered the question with Pokemon, but has anyone linked a retail purchase? Are you pouring sparkling water next to your microphone?
No, it's pretty far away.
Has anyone linked a retail blind purchase to a gaming experience, but also a blind experience in a gaming? In a gaming environment. So, for example, say you could buy, I don't know, a pack of football stickers or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and you open it up and, oh shit, I've got this QR code in here, and or there's a code, and I put it into the game and I get a week of Lionel Messi being my star forward or whatever. You know what I mean? So kind of linking those two worlds. Has anybody done that?
Yes. And it's actually not the usual suspect. It's Nintendo. Nintendo has this Animal Crossing game series. It's meant to be a very cozy game, suitable for young people, certainly. Very popular also amongst female players, for example. And they released this series of physical card packs featuring different characters. Some characters are, of course, more desirable than other characters because it's an animal that more people like, or the animal is in a color that more people like, or that animal has a personality that more people like. But the point is, what you can do with that card, that random card that you obtained, is you can scan it into the game and the character appears in your game. And nice. My understanding is that actually no card is rarer than another card. They actually have the same rarity of appearing. Cool. But it's just that some are just more desirable subjectively on the secondary market. And for
example, which animals are more popular?
Is there a capybara?
I don't think the capybaras got popular when the last game was released, but there's a very popular cat. At least there was a very popular cat that had eyes that were of different colors. That was a very popular one. Didn't and people were paying quite a lot, either with virtual items or indeed with real money, trying to get this villager to move into their village. And this is actually an interesting point that we should note here, is that a lot of the time, video game loot boxes are not regulable by existing gambling law, because whatever you open stays with your account, you can't sell it to anybody else. That is the position in nearly all countries except Belgium that we talked about earlier. But with these blind boxes and with these car packs, they actually contravene the gambling laws of most countries, which very clearly say that if you offer a product for money that contains random rewards, and some of those random rewards are more valuable than others, that's a gambling product. In the UK, for example, car packs, blind boxes, they would contravene the Gambling Act.
But if Animal Crossing, if the scarcity is identical for all of them, then there is no... any value is implied. It's not real, surely.
That does not matter. The law does not account for whether or not you designed it to be. But the point is that for that specific item, it's random whether or not you get it, number one. Yeah, yeah. And then how much value people then attach to it, we're not particularly concerned, as long as people do attach value to it, and people do.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not really a requirement. I see what you mean.
Yeah, it's a really weird one, that, because it's not sold with that intention. It's, but that's something that's happened to it because of human nature.
Mm, yeah, yeah. But that's actually a quite a special example. That one, for some reason,
that's, I think, things
had equal probabilities.
Brilliant.
But most car packs very clearly have rewards or cars that are much rarer than others. You recently had a Lord of the Ring collaboration with Magic the Gathering. And there was one card, there was only one copy of this card that exists in the whole wide world, because it is the One Ring, from the story, of course. And Post Malone bought it for about $2 million. And this is not like one of those really old cards that's been around for 30, 40 years, but it has somehow remained in pristine condition that a collector decided to buy. This was a recently released product that someone purchased. And what's also interesting about that is it used to be that with these car packs, it only costed $3, $4, $5 to purchase a pack. So it didn't hurt that much. to open one now and again. But with the packs that could potentially have contained that one card, it was being sold for $100. So the risk that one has to undertake for a chance at that is a lot higher. And I don't think it's inconceivable to say that there were people who were treating this as a lottery, because that's what it was.
That's what it is, yeah.
Totally.
But and it's really also a lot more expensive lottery, right?
Yeah.
$100 a pop is
But it's also so annoying that the guy that now owns it didn't even go down to his news agents and buy the fucking packs. He's just swung in and gone, I'll have that, young man.
And that probably is the correct way that one should engage with these products. Yeah, you know, within these card collecting card game communities, it is well known that you should never open packs. You should buy singles. Singles being single individual cards that are known on the secondary market. And to me, this is quite interesting in that it's not possible in the video game loot box context to decide not to engage with a randomized process and just directly buy things. Video games don't let you do that. Most don't. But in this physical context, and if we come back to the Labubu blind boxes, if you do not want to actually engage in the gambling-like behavior, you can just go to the secondary market and buy things directly. Are you paying more than how much it would have costed you if you try to get this secret rare item from one box? Yes. But actually, they're not being sold for that much more than I think they're sold for the prices of a couple of boxes, not too many. So if you really wanted the rare one, there is the possibility of just buying it, and you don't have to engage with the gambling aspect.
Yeah, but you know that I think that that's what it's all about, you know, because what's the gambling aspect? The gambling aspect is the unexpectedness. I don't know how you put it. It's the anticipation.
Yep.
It's all about
sure.
anticipation, right? And in the moment of anticipation, you know, you release the dopamine. And that's, you know, what it's all about. And that's, you know, it originates all from Pavlov's, Skinner's, you know, experiments with rats. And they found out, okay, if the rat presses the lever, it releases the most dopamine, and not when it's rewarded the food just, you know, becomes uninteresting at some point of time. It's really at that point of time when you purchase it, when you are about to open it, that's what's interesting. And that's what the gambling is about, you know. You could just, you know, give people things, you know, but that's not, you know, what they actually want, you know. They want this, you know, uncertainty. They want the thrill.
They
want to feel lucky. Exactly. You know, it's like, you know, it's like about, you know, everything else, you know. I mean, erotics, etc., right? You don't want the naked woman. You want the woman, you know, wrapped up nicely into some stuff that, you know, conceals what you're actually looking for. No.
What a sideways step that was.
A small sideways step. But that's what it's about, you know, and that's why all of these products are so interesting. And especially for the kids, you know. Because I mean, for the kids, you know, it's this anticipation, you know, I'm gonna get this. I mean, that's why we have givings, that's why we wrap up presents at Christmas, you know. Why would we wrap them up? You know, we just, you know, toss them under the Christmas tree, but we wrap it up to make it more interesting, to increase, you know, the anticipation. I'm sure, I mean, Leon, you can relate to that. I mean, you also probably have annual festivities where you wrap things up rather than just, you know, give it to somebody as it is.
I certainly, in terms of the opening experience, we know that the companies are paying a lot of attention to design this to be as
exactly look as look at sneakers or you know how your whatever you know
the unboxing experience. Absolutely. And in fact we know that and this again comes back to what we were talking about earlier, John, about these products learning from each other, right? We know that in the Magic the Gathering context, they specifically now have a program of research and design within the company that tries to make the card pack opening experience more exciting. So they present certain things in a certain order. And of course, the rarest things are at the end. So it takes a while, it builds it up, and then you get there. But I think it's important to note that with the loot boxes, it is usually a mandatory and forced engagement with the gambling product. But that's not necessarily true with the physical product because of the secondary market. And the law, interestingly, desires to more strictly regulate products that have a secondary market, when I think, in fact, that the secondary market could act as a way for at least some people to decide not to engage with the gambling mechanisms and reduce the harm that they might experience from this product. And I would say that we should do more work looking at individual differences, which is more relevant for the physical product context than it is for the loot box context, because of this, because you have a choice in the physical context whether or not to engage.
Yeah.
So it's more interesting to see.
There's fuel for research there for probably the rest of all of our lives.
Leon, other, you know, than, you know, protecting, you know, the youth, what are, you know, typical vulnerabilities for getting hooked on loot boxes, on getting blind boxes? Like,
comorbidities?
Who are the vulnerable groups? Has there been any research into that?
Yes, less so on the young people side. I mean, you have some things like experiencing gambling harm is linked to purchasing loot boxes, but that doesn't say too much about risk factors. But in the adult context, there has been large-scale research, and it is the usual suspects for other addictive products as well, including lower socioeconomic status, lower educational attainment, etc. Impulsivity has not actually been as relevant as one might think.
What's the difference? Let's say, you know, I'm of course most familiar with gambling and problem gambling severity index, other screening instruments.
Yeah.
Like, how different are these instruments to, let's say, diagnosing, identifying a issue, whatever the issue might be with loot boxes? So what, you know, what are you asking participants when you try to assess the level of involvement, addiction, whatever you will call it, with loot boxes?
Most studies just ask for spending. Just one, the spending in the past.
So it all comes down to money lost. My opinion, not wrong, but it's very one-sided. And I see in gambling, we're also a little bit gravitating towards connecting everything with money lost. Whereas, you know, a person could have spent a lot of time doing it, but maybe they are a pretty good gamer, you know, and they buy loot boxes additionally, and they just spend too much time. They neglect their education, their family, I don't know what. Or they feel guilty about it, or they are criticized by their partner and their relationship breaks up. Lots of issues, you know, could be caused by excessive loot boxes, excessive gambling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this really comes back actually to the research that you have been doing, in that unlike in the gambling context, video game companies have not been open at all to sharing data.
Is there any, you know, any study? I mean, I didn't find any that had access to actual player data from an online gaming platform, or is it all based on self-reported information?
it's all self-reports, except this one study that was quite recent that was done at the Harvard Business School. But that one used data that was from a game that has already been discontinued. So it was not possible to connect that data to real players and human psychology as an ongoing thing. It was just a review of the data of players historically. Mm. And it did identify certain things such as whales. Whales exists, of course they do, but it was good to confirm things
That's a good point that you're making. In casino gambling, usually there is a very top-heavy distribution, you know? So a one-sided distribution. So you have a small percentage of players that generate the most revenue. I mean, operators can argue, you know, against it, but it simply holds true pretty much generally. In lotteries, it's different, right? Because in the lottery, you have a vast amount of people who purchase, you know, a couple of tickets. So it's more or less equally distributed. But in casino gambling, you have a couple of guys who really love it a lot, maybe too much. Is this also true for video gaming, that you have a few who spend, you know, ages, spend a lot of money, and then you have the majority of them who are, you know, recreational players who contribute monetary and what are time very little.
Yeah, and this is true from both the self-reported data and also from that one study based on a Japanese game, the historical data. But I think it's important to, again, come back to thinking about the differences between at least the loot boxes. This is not necessarily true for the, it's also probably true, actually, for the car packs, the blind boxes, in that it's also not a zero-sum game, in that it is possible to manipulate the product design in such a way that not necessarily maximizes revenue, but rather have a more even distribution of spending, which might reduce harm. Because
so you're saying they can do something like, for example, in gambling. I mean, there are, for example, limits, right? So I'd say pretty much every regulated online gambling market has, you know, to provide players with limits. Whether, you know, they set those limits or not, that's up to them. There are also countries where millions are mandatory. But in online gaming, do players have this option that to limit how much time they want to spend, how much money they want to spend, or is this option not there?
Very few games would provide such an option. It might be part of parental control features in a few games. But for example, what we talked about earlier about those guarantee or pity mechanics, they can act effectively as the limit on spending, because for most players, once they reach that, once they have that, that's it. They're done.
Understand.
So you can design it in such a way that your average player is expected to reach the pity mechanic every 3 months, and it costs maybe about $50 to reach that every 3 months. So you're looking at someone spending $50 every 3 months or $200 a year.
So what you're saying is, you're saying the pity mechanic is actually not so bad because it's more transparent than communicating, like, you know, a return to player, because the person knows, okay, after 90 purchases, I will get a rare item. And I just have to do those 90. I might get it before, but I definitely 100% deterministically will get it at the 19th.
So it's
time.
A protective mechanism, ultimately, which is very interesting, because it limits what they will spend.
Generally speaking, yes. So you know, for example, each loot box costs $3 and then it's guaranteed after 90, then you can calculate, it will cost me $270 max to get this. But I think it's also a double-edged sword. Yeah. Because let's say someone planned on purchasing 30 loot boxes, or maybe they planned on purchasing 60 loot boxes. They didn't get the thing, And then they see this message saying, if you purchase 90 loot boxes, you're guaranteed to get this thing. Then maybe they will be tempted to spend that extra money to get those 30 more loot boxes to reach that target, right?
Yeah, because do they even communicate that everywhere? I mean, like, is this, because I'm assuming, okay, I play a game, et cetera, et cetera. I mean,
do I
even look at the terms and conditions, you know, the small print? Do I even understand? Do I even speak the language? I mean, it's not like that you, a pop-up comes up, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and explains, hey, you know, after 90 games, you're going to win it. That's somewhere in the small print.
Actually, my understanding, at least for the more engaged players, all of them know this, because compared to other information about the product, this one is actually quite prominently advertised. Because I think in some ways, yes, it potentially could add as a protective feature, like John said, but it is also a promotional message.
Mm.
If you purchase 10, you're guaranteed to get one. It also has the effect of potentially increasing revenue. Certainly a lot of research should be done on these mechanics. I'm surprised. Like, we've been talking about these mechanics for a number of years, but there's been very little focused research just on this point, even though it's being implemented in the context of most loot boxes now. And people do actually expect this to be part of the game design of new games.
Okay, so it's so normal, you know.
Yes,
removing it
very much so.
Completely change the game.
Yes, players will definitely protest if it's removed.
Yeah, right.
And if a new game comes out without it, people would be questioning whether or not you should engage with it.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. One of the things, and this isn't a natural progression from what we were just talking about at all. One of the things that me and Michael were talking about when we were talking about this exact episode, in fact, we were looking at lots of, there's quite a bit of research on blind boxes, mostly by Chinese academics.
Yeah.
But if I remember correctly, blind boxes are not allowed to be sold within China. Is that right?
No. They're perfectly allowed. And in fact, they still generate most of their revenue from China. It's there is a little bit of regulation in relation to underage players or underage consumers. So if you're underage,
like, limited.
But there was one case, wasn't it? Like this one company which made tons of money with blind boxes, and there was one regulation was introduced or something. I can't remember what the company was called.
You may be referring to earlier this year, where the main company this is Pop Mart, but
exactly,
it was not. But it was not any new regulation. It was just an article criticizing the practice in the state media. That is very effective at reducing the stock prices of any company. It's kind of similar to the, for example, the in relation to video games, there was the digital opium criticism. It's then the stock price of video game markets dropped. It's a criticism, but at the moment, no regulation except in relation to young people.
And loot box regulation is there nothing in China with that?
China is actually was actually the first to introduce dedicated loot box regulation, but it was not restrictive. It was just publish the probabilities.
Coming back to the blind boxes, so what you're saying is, it's similar to, let's say, scratch cards can be purchased by somebody under 18 or under 16, whatever the country is, but for the blind boxes, aren't the products often meant for children?
So if you are under 8, single digit, right, 8, okay, you're not allowed to purchase.
But
if you're between, like, I think it's somewhere between 8 and 18 or something like that, you need to the staff member from the store is meant to get parental consent before selling it. But there has been reports from China, from journalists finding that, I mean, obviously there's very little enforcement. I think you're right that a lot of these products are intended or targeting children. But actually, I think a vast amount of the spending is coming from adults. And this kind of comes to a wider discussion about this concept of kidulting and collecting in general. It's normalized now, and quite rightly perhaps, that even if you are an adult, you can still collect toys. You can still have cute things on your desk.
Show us your collection, Leon. Show us your collection.
It's not with me.
I think a whole room for it, haven't you?
I think, you know, this white patch of wall behind you is the only white patch you probably have in your office. Everything else is stuffed with labubus and...
He's seen right through you.
Action figures and...
It's probably a digital background.
Spider-Man shirt behind your... under your...
Just go and
fly away.
Fantastic. Leon, thank you so much for joining us and being our first guest, which is very, very exciting. I'm sure we're probably going to think up some more questions as soon as I hit stop as well.
Yeah, and we can always revisit this, you know. I mean, research is going on, and let's, you know, Leon, together try to get a hold of some, you know, online gaming data. That would be amazing, you know, if we'd get a hold of a data set and just, you know, compute things like what's the average playing time, you know, how often do they play, how many different types of games do they play, you know, those kinds of things that, you know, we started to do in gambling long time ago, just to get an idea, you know, about people's behavior.
Well, time is the critical ingredient of harm in video gaming, isn't it? As opposed to gambling.
Well, I actually tend to think of the time and the money things as potentially separate. I can see how there might be compounded harm. But the thing is that actually quite a few of the leading game companies have shared data with select researchers in relation to video game playtime.
Yeah.
And they have done research that is supportive of the industry's commercial interest. And this sort of raises an interesting question. Why has there been data sharing resulting in research that is either positive or at worst neutral about the video game interest commercial interests, but no data sharing of data, spending data, that perhaps might go the other way? And I do think it will be naive, I think, to think that the video game companies have not done this research themselves already based off of their own spending data. I think they know.
Sure they do, of course. I mean, it's like gambling, you know, there's so much investment into targeted marketing, personalization, etc.
Right.
Very, very little is applied, you know, for player protection, although we know it works perfectly.
Well, Electronic Arts is worth $43 billion.
Yeah, makes a difference, yeah.
So I'm pretty sure they've done some research.
43 and, more than I.
And I mean, like, they've been around for, God, EA's been publishing since late 80s.
Yeah.
And you know, they were huge in the early 90s. They had the Madden series, they had the NHL series, big on Nintendo, massive on Sega, etc. You know, they've been around, they've been developing these practices, and there's a reason they're worth $43 billion now, because they've perfected some of this. And you know, it's not cynical to say that, and it's also not cynical to say they are almost certainly going to protect that. And I'm sure that a reasonable amount of their $43 billion is spent on lawyers. And if any of them are listening, I love you.
But like in gambling, you know, I mean, we clearly shown that, you know, if you introduce transparency, responsibility, you can create an even more loyal person because they're going to play longer, because they will do it in a reasonable way.
It's a more valuable long relationship rather than a rinsed, short, problematic one.
Yes.
I mean, the data's out there, right? And talking about learning from each other, then, you know, regulation is going to come. to video gaming. There's no two ways about it. And it doesn't matter how many lawyers they've got. If enough countries do it, there's not going to be any way to argue against it. But regulation is going to come to loot boxes internationally.
And another interesting observation to make here is actually that EA, for example, is not necessarily too against more regulation. Just like how big social media companies are not particularly against stricter regulation because it's a good anti-competition measure. It means that smaller companies have a much harder time trying to make it. I think, for example, in the gambling context, it's really quite unimaginable for a new company to decide, I want to be a new gambling operator from nothing because of the licensing requirements, all of the regulatory requirements, all the compliance things they must do. The startup cost is so high. And it benefits the companies that are already established, right? Because they can meet those costs. So, yes, but... Yeah, maybe more regulation is not necessarily that bad for the big companies.
No, it's a very fair point. A very fair point. But I was wrapping this up 10 minutes ago. See what I mean? This conversation could go on forever because it is really, really fascinating subject. And I can't wait to see the research that you're going to be coming out within the next 12 to 24 months. I think it's going to be big. Sorry, Michael.
We'll stay in touch, and I gotta get to the chopper. You know.
I'm so sorry. I've been saying to Michael that I'm gonna make sure he says "get to the chopper" once an episode.
No, because... get to the chopper. That's how you say it in real Austrian English.
Because he's Austrian and Arnold Schwarzenegger is also Austrian, yes, yes. etc. So I'm sorry about that.
I almost look like him. I mean, muscle wise, of course.
Obviously, yes, very much so. That's why we've had to do this as an audio-only podcast.
Yeah,
because I didn't want people to be distracted.
But get scared off by my amazing physique.
Exactly. We would have listeners or viewers just crying as they watched without understanding.
I mean, we have Arnold here. We have Jackie Chan over there. And I'm not sure who you would represent from the UK. I don't know.
I don't know. Probably Phil Collins.
Phil Collins. But only because you're bored.
Yeah, exactly. I've got no talent. Mind you, it's been argued that nor has Phil Collins. Leon, thank you very, very much. It's been a real pleasure. Really appreciate
it. It's great talking to you. Let's stay in touch,
Leon. Yes, good to have a chat.